And then kind of move into how I got involved in the Dharma, some of the keys to, I would say, what is an engaged life? What is a life inspired by the Dharma going out into the world and acting and giving? And what does it look like, and what are the blocks and problems that we face when going out into the world based on the Dharma teaching or the spiritual teachings? How can we actually be more effective using the Dharma teachings as our ground? So first, a few words about my life. It's strange, but I think that my interest in spirituality came as a child, and I think for most of us it comes as a child, where I just remember at the age of 5, 6, 7 being utterly taken over by the mystery of the bigness of things. Things seemed to be so big. And I was a child, I was like this, and at the same time rather disappointed in the adults around me that sort of forgot how big things were. And it's interesting that the Buddha had a similar kind of experience, that there was a time when he was stuck in his own journey, and he was more tied into a kind of Hindu ascetic practice. And at a certain point he said, I remembered my childhood when I was sitting under a tree, and I felt the joy and the concentration and the simplicity while my father was doing agricultural work, and I was sitting under the tree feeling the joy and the bigness of life. And for this, when he remembered that, it set him on a new path, and from this new path he became enlightened. So his referral to his own childhood was actually an important turning point in his own practice. I was educated in London, and then I went to Oxford University for my education, which was in biochemistry. And then at that time I had a kind of second awakening, which wasn't in Oxford, it was right here. I was working in the summer at Stanford University in Palo Alto, and it was 1966, which was the great explosion of something really new and fresh and amazing that was happening right here. So I just by accident fell in the middle of it, and that was the explosion of creative inner life of the 60s. So I came back with that to Oxford, finished my education, but something did change with me on an inner level through my experiences here. That was 45 years ago. I think actually, if I want to pin it down exactly to what it was that changed for me here, was the experience that when I looked at a tree, or when I looked at a plant, or I sat opposite the Pacific Ocean on the shoreline near somewhere, things were not as sure anymore. That reality had a question mark around it. It wasn't just as I saw it. A tree wasn't just a tree. It was a question. What is this? A hypothesis. That's something that changed for me then. And then I went to London and did a doctorate in medical research, so I have a medical professional background. And the government sent me to India. Again, I really didn't know why I was going to India, but the government sent me to India to teach in Indian universities. And I arrived in Varanasi, which is a great holy city in the north of India on the Mother Ganges. And this holy city attracts pilgrims from all over India. And the banks of the Ganges were full of people who were renounced completely, who left their family, left it full, hundreds, thousands, left everything in their life. And they may have been professors, and they may have been teachers, and they may have been doctors, but you wouldn't know it because they're sitting there with their orange robes around fires and practicing meditation under trees and with nothing in their life except maybe a small bag and a bit of food, and that's it. So that's an old Indian tradition, just to renounce and to walk across India from temple to temple, seeking spirituality or realization. And it's wonderful, it was wonderful to me to be inside a culture where that was the most important thing. And even if people couldn't, they were in their ordinary life, they couldn't be full-time spiritual adventurers, seekers, it was in the culture. That was 1975. I found that really strong. If you imagine how it would be that if you go out in the street here, right here, everybody you meet was somehow connected to something spiritual. That's what it felt like in Varanasi. In the people before they got up in, when they got up in the morning, they would bless their, a carpenter would bless their tools with mantra and prayer, would bless the hammer and offer incense and worship to the tools so that the tools would serve him well when he built something with the hammer. And a person was healing, or a doctor would give with mantras and prayers the medicine, not just how much you want to, you know, $50 or whatever it is. So you can imagine a life where everything, it's in every corner. And this for me was very, very strong, to live like that for 1 year. Well, I was in the university there in Varanasi, but I was spent most of my time actually sitting on the banks of the Ganges River. And my students sometimes, even though they were students in biochemistry and they found this a bit strange, I said, you find me on the Ganges, I'm there. You should be there. Get out of your laboratory. Come and sit by the Ganges. You'll learn more about life on the banks of the Ganges River than you'll ever learn in the laboratory there. So that was India. And of course, then I learned more formally meditation. I went to some retreats with Goenka, the Buddhist teacher that you may have heard of. A very wonderful teacher, but very strict. And from then on, I did 1975-6, I started going to regularly to retreats of 10 days. And I used to do it, then I got married and had children, but like clockwork, every year, two or three times, said to my wife, sorry, I am out. I don't exist for you. 10 days, I don't exist. Forget that I exist. Don't try and phone me, I'm out. And at the beginning she objected, and then she saw I was just a better husband. By going to retreats, something different was happening to me. I was softer, I was more accommodating, and our married life just got better because of the retreats. So I said, you're getting the benefit. You're the first person that I see after the retreat, so you're getting the benefit of the retreat. So she understood it, and we didn't have a problem. But I used to do that regularly, go to a kind of monastic center in England two or three times a year for 10 days. And then I moved to Israel and started a community in Israel based on the teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. And it was already at that time a sense that I really wanted to give to the world, that it wasn't, sitting on the cushion wasn't enough, that it had to be out there in life, because the Dharma is about life. It's not about some withdrawal. Even if historically there has been a tendency to monasticize a Buddhist teaching, that it's been historically and culturally like the top of the pyramid has been the monastery, and then The communities, like in Thailand or Cambodia or Sri Lanka, the communities tended to kind of look up to the monastery and the monks, and what they did was the real Buddhism, and what what happened in the community tended to be kind of second. But that's historically, it's not in the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddhist teachings definitely said that lay people in the community can and should practice and realize and lead an enlightened life. You don't just lead an enlightened life in a monastery. So obviously not, because you're only sitting 1 hour a day or whatever it is, or going on retreat, but what about 24 hours? Then are you forgetting it all for 24 hours? No, it really should be in every action, every word. That's the eightfold path of the Dharma. It's in every word, in every action. So clearly, compassionate action has to be part of the spiritual life. So that one of the first things that happened is that I helped to establish a community in Israel, or a village, shall we say. It's not exactly a community. And I still live there now. That was 25, 30 years later, where there's now 400 people living there, and still keeping largely to some main principles. It's an ecological village, it's off-grid, we don't have electricity, we live more simply, we grow our food, we have alternative schooling for the children, and it's a very beautiful place. And it's a village, and it doesn't have... and it's a peace-oriented village. We have a lot of relationships with Arabs around, Arabs, Jews. So I won't go into that, the details now, but I would say it's quite a unique place in Israel still today, and people come from all over Israel and enjoy to stay with us and to have this sense of peace and beauty and dedication to the land and to the earth, which is still there 30 years later. And it's well established now. We have a graveyard. I did hear someone said, you don't exist as a village or a settlement until you have a graveyard. So we do. And we have all the generations, small children and grandparents. In the end of the 80s, still no one in Israel was practicing Dharma or Buddhism, Buddhist practice. There was a bit in the university, but really no practice available. And when I mentioned it, people thought I was cuckoo. I was something wrong with this guy. What's he talking about? Well, it's not enough. We have three great religions here, and you need another one? I said, because you've got three great religions, we need another one. You three great religions, you screwed it up. You're fighting each other all the time. We need something new. So I began to bring on my own, just bring Buddhist meditation teachers over to Israel, invited people to my house, brought teachers like Christopher Titmus, Stephen Batchelor, Fred von Ullman, teachers, international teachers. I would just bring them to my house, convert my house to a meditation retreat, devote myself completely to that, and have courses for several years, and invite people, just like, you know, same number of people, 20, 30 people, sitting for 10 days in my house on retreat. So that's what how it all began. And then from there, I opened the Israeli Insight Society, which has now become the main Theravada-oriented Dharma society or Sangha in Israel. And we have around now thousands of people, we have maybe 8,000 people in the mailing list, and a couple of thousand people sit retreats every year. And we have this year 35 retreats. So it's big, it's got big, and it's wonderful. It's amazing. We have several teachers as well. We have now six, seven teachers, including myself, And the whole Sangha is basically run from or by volunteers. We have one salary, one or half salaries divided between two or three people, but their role is minimal. The whole thing is run by volunteers. And we have groups and teams of volunteers that do the advertising, that do the website, that do that run the retreats, that cook in the retreats, that organize the retreats, that do community activities. We have classes in 15 prisons in Israel. We have groups of mothers. We have retreats for sick people. We have lots of activities going on. We have sitting groups, maybe 20 like this, probably smaller, but we have groups like this that sit in all over Israel, 20 perhaps sitting groups, affiliated. So we do a lot, and it's all based on volunteers and no money. We don't charge for our retreats. They're all based on dana, not just the teachers, also the retreat itself, the accommodation and the food, everything. We never charge anything. People come, and at the end they give dana, and we just manage to survive. We don't have donors, big rich people, but the people appreciate what we're doing, and they do give and support the whole thing. So it's quite wonderful, and something about the atmosphere is very, very special. We really don't have fights and conflicts that happen in so many organizations over time. It's classical. Organizations invite conflict because there's egos and there's power, and there is boundaries, and it's natural. I talked about this before, but we really don't have. It doesn't mean to say there won't be tomorrow, but we work within the organization all the time to facilitate problems before they really fester as a wound. We try to really nip in the bud any woundedness that people feel, or threat, or being put down. And we invite people to express this in groups, and we facilitate. For example, just now we had six meetings of the teachers and the senior volunteers to avoid any gap in communication and difficulties that happen between the teachers and the managing group, which can happen so often, even in the Dharma organization, that the teachers are somehow up there and the managing group are distant and building up in the space possible conflict. So we work together to try and heal, and we feel this is very important and giving energy to the whole organization. So so far it's been really it's wonderful, and it's growing all the time, and we've got a very good name in Israel. People know about us, and I think because of that sensitivity to even the quality of the meetings that we have, and they're personal, and we really try and get that quality right, that people are invited in and can express their own feelings and even their emotions inside. Okay, it's Israel too, so people actually easier to talk and share their feelings. So that than in Europe or in America. It's Middle Eastern, so people are out there more expressive. So that does help. People don't hold things inside quite as much. They more easily express. But still, potential for conflict is there all the time, and we do try and be very aware of this and invite issues before they become difficult. So so let me turn to the issues of engagement. In a way, the Buddhist teaching is not, as I say, is not a private individual thing. The core of the Buddhist teaching is engagement in the world through the acts of generosity, through acts of giving, teaching, expressing the Dharma, through relationship, through helping peace. Because underneath, as Suzuki said, you mentioned Suzuki, there isn't such a thing as an enlightened person. There is only enlightened action. We are in relationship all the time. Every time we open our mouth, we open our eyes, we're in relationship. We're not closed and locked in. So the relationship is the basis of our Dharma. So in some way all Buddhism is engaged or connected to the world. It's not locked in. So it's not a question of we should be engaged in the world. It's we are already engaged in the world. How are we going to do it right? And many of us feel that we're not ready to help other people. We need to be more perfect. We need to be... How can we help other people if I'm full of ego? Many of us feel we're not ready. We hear the Buddhist teaching, have to be, get rid of the self, and then I can go out and help the world. And I'm full of self. I'm full of myself, so I better not do anything. I better stay at home. We often have other problems, like I didn't mention that we do a lot of peace work in Israel, and it's coming from the Dharma community. We go out into the Palestinian world, we bring Israelis and Palestinians together and so on, and very often people say, I'm not ready for this kind of work. It's too much for me. I feel exhausted. I feel helpless. I feel powerless. All the conflicts are too big for me. I can't do anything. In any way, even if I did do something, it wouldn't work. So lots of different views that would discourage people from going out and engaging. So I wanted to sort of address that a little bit. The first thing is that we need to step back from being attached to results or outcomes or what we want to achieve there. Every organization kind of works like that. They say, what's the bottom line? Where are we trying to get to? What's the goal? And did we get there? The Dharma doesn't go in that direction. The Dharma says, leave the goal and work with the means. Work with the way, not with the bottom line that you want to achieve. How are you acting? Not what do you want to achieve? Because in the how you're acting is already the result. The way you do things, the quality of your action, action that's compassionate, an action that's listening, an action that's wise and open, an action of love and devotion, respect, fundamental, an action that has respect in it, is already a peacemaking action. The English word respect is very nice because it comes from the Latin of specare, I think it is, means someone...
Spectare.
Yeah, it means to see. And respect means to look again. To look again at someone. To see someone else. The basis of respect. So, the quality of these actions, of your actions, that's actually in the Dharma what the result. It's not that you get anywhere, you do anything in order to get there. And if you'd be amazed at how many people trying to do peace are doing it with so much anger and so much shouting and so much fighting, and waving, they want to be heard, and they're just creating so much more violence in the name of peace. And you know how many wars starting in the name of freedom? Everyone who starts wars would say, oh, I'm fighting for freedom, sounds very nice, and fighting for democracy, sounds very nice, and fighting for liberation or whatever. The wars are fought in the name of good qualities, like William Blake said, the road to hell is paved by good intentions. So we need to embody the action rather than go for the bottom line. And that's Dharma. And if we step back from that busyness just getting there, something very special happens. We find that we ourselves become empowered by the action that we're doing, because we're doing it with harmony, or with a sense of we're benefiting at the same time as giving to others. And so a lot of people who go out in the community, whether they're working with old people, working with sick people, working with dying people, there are quite a few people from the Dharma community go into the hospice, and I'm sure they do also here in the States, and go and in every case, you as a participator will benefit at the same time as you're benefiting others. It's not that you just have to sweat and struggle and have a great difficulty because of the bottom line, what you want to achieve over there. You step back and ask, in the present moment, what's the quality of my actions? Am I helping? And what's the present, in the present, what's going on? And this is restoring us. And people who work in this way do not find themselves so exhausted and so overwhelmed by having to go out in the community and struggle against so much resistance and so much difficulty. And in some way or other, we are never really ready in samsara. We're never really cooked. We are always on the path somewhere. We can't say, well, I'm not going to help other people until I'm cooked, until I've sat hundreds of retreats and I'm done. We're always challenged. We're always tested by life. We're always finding our test of our energy, test of our insight, and that's fine. And so we can regard anything we want to do in life, like, for example, even in our workplace, going into our work and expressing things a little differently. Faced with an issue or a problem in our work or in our family, how are we at that moment? What's the quality of our inner life? What's coming out of our eyes when we look at somebody? Is it respect? Is it inner quietness? Do we bring the atmosphere of meditation and calmness and steadiness into that moment when someone says something stupid or difficult or hurtful to us or to somebody else? Can we bring at that moment a quality that changes the atmosphere? That's Dharma. It can be very small. You don't have to do peace work between Israelis and Palestinians. Just you get up in the morning, and there's so many opportunities at any minute to change the quality of a moment where otherwise there will be more ignorance or more suffering or more conflict or more loneliness or more sickness, whatever. So this is a challenge for us, but we don't need to wait. We can do it now. We don't need to wait until we're somehow perfect. That's the field of practice, just like when we sit on the cushion And our field of practice is a conflict in the body, such as a stress. They're same. We attend to it with kindness, with attention, and with respect. Our knee is hurting, we are there. We give kindness, we give attention, we don't try and shut it off, we don't try and push it away. We invite a dialogue, we invite it in, this pain. So same with the world. It's not different, it's our challenge. In some way the path, we're always in the beginning and we're always in the end. And it's very interesting, the Buddha said the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. And I'm still in a way addressing this sense that we might not feel ready, but just to be aware that in a way there's something timeless here. The beginning is also the end. For example, the Eightfold Path is the path of the Buddha, which is very much a path in life, because it talks about right speech, right action, right livelihood or right activity in life, and so on. Right morality, integrity. The Eightfold Path, you can take it at many, many levels, but one level is that it's there for us as practice to bring us to an awakened life, but it's also the result of an awakened life. So how we speak is both a practice to bring us to awakening, it's also the result of awakening. The Eightfold Path is at the beginning. The Noble Eightfold Path is after we've practiced. And I don't know if you know that distinction. There is silence and there is noble silence. In the Dharma there, it's Ariya, means nobility. Nobility is translated as someone that has some degree of understanding of not-self, meaning less self-obsessed, less self-important, less full of myself and what I want, is called a noble person, a noble one. In the traditional Buddhist teachings of 2,500 years ago, this word Ariya means nobility, and it means someone that has realized to some extent, not all the way, but to some extent, non-self, or more emptiness, more openness, less self-obsession. So the Noble Eightfold Path is the path of someone who is already realized after practicing some inner truth of non-self or of emptiness. And the Ordinary Eightfold Path is more at the beginning. Still the Eightfold Path, still doing the same thing. How you speak, how you act, how you think, what are your intentions, what is your calmness, what is your energy, all same. So the beginning is also in the middle and also at the end. It's really one, the path is one path, and there's benefits at all levels. One of the things that we may need to pay attention to, though, is we need to find a balance between giving to ourselves and giving to others. Basically, there is no difference. We act, an act of speech or an act of eating is us and the world. But we do need to be wise about giving to ourselves as well as giving to the world. And we can often get a little stuck with there. Say, be too much giving to the world, I must do this and I must do that and I must run here and I must run there, and somehow or other we find ourselves contracted and just in habits of giving to others or of some sort of compulsion to give to others. Whereas the opposite, when we are just, as I said, busy on the cushion, I need to look after myself, I need to watch myself, what I eat, how I practice, I need to go on retreats, I need to look after myself, it's also in a way painful because it's too much self, busy with myself and what I need, giving to myself. So this sense of sometimes we need to retreat and be with ourselves is very important, and sometimes with others. To find that balance is not necessarily easy, but we learn it in our life, this balance between giving to ourself and giving to others, inner quiet and engagement with life. And then back to inner quiet, our meditation time, and back into life. And find that balance, and that's not always so easy. When you practice more, slowly, slowly, these differences don't become so big, because there's more quiet in action. Like life becomes a monastery. Like the Zen story of the head of the monastery, who the student asked him, "What's the highest thing you can do?" He said, "Meditation. Sitting. I sit in meditation. That's the highest thing that I can do." So the student said, "But master, I never see you sitting. You're doing the accounts of the money in writing the books, you're welcoming guests, you're digging in the garden, you're cleaning, you're running the monastery. I never see you sitting for 1 minute." And the head of the monastery said, "Yeah, I'm cleaning, I'm helping to cook, I'm welcoming guests, I'm doing the accounts of the monastery, I'm teaching, but I never stop sitting in meditation." So it breaks down that difference. But on the way, we may not yet feel there, and so we may need really to take time off, and it is important that we do take time off and we find that balance between time off, giving to ourselves, and time giving to others. I'm going to sort of close in a moment so that we can have some questions. One of the things that is important is to stay kind of innocent in our relationship with action in life, with what we do in our life, to have a sense of that we really don't quite know. It's not that we are idiots, but that it's helpful to be, and this is really special to the Dharma, it's helpful not to be attached to our views, our opinions, our conclusions, to be open and have more of a questioning, open attitude. I remember a small personal story that illustrates this. All my life, I've been, since India in 75, been a vegetarian, or mostly I had never eaten meat or anything like that. I've been a pacifist. I refused to handle any weapons. The Israel army was a bit upset with me. But I've been very much aligned with non-violence. So one day in my village, the army came around and said, "You have to guard. You must set a guard at the entrance to the village. There's some disturbance. You need to guard, and someone with a gun has to stand at the entrance to the village." So everybody said, "Okay, well, you take turns," and they have a list of names and so on, and my name was there. And I said, "No, what, me standing with a gun at the entrance to the village? Life 30 years pacifist, and you want me to stand there with a gun?" And I said, "No, not me. Find somebody else." And then my friend said to me, "You know, you say you're a pacifist. On aren't you too old to live on principles like that? I thought about it, it's a very wise thing. So I said, you know what? Okay, you're right. You know what? You're right. So I went back to the organizer and said, okay, I will stand there. Give me a gun. I had no idea how to, which end. Never used one in my life. Don't know what to do with it. Anyway, so I stood at the entrance to the village, and a car with Arabs came to the village, and there was four Arab guys in the car, and I was standing there with a gun. So I stopped the car, and I thought, well, what am I supposed to do? do I regard them as my enemies? Well, obviously not, but still I have to do something. So they stopped, and they rolled down the window, and I said hi, and I explained to them that we need to guard the entrance to the village because something happened, and I don't exactly know what, but I almost apologized that I was standing there with a gun. And they said, oh, it's very good and very important that someone stands guard. It's very important. So, they said they're going to look after their olive trees because we have olive trees of the Arab community inside our village and the Jewish, you know, we're mixed. And then they said goodbye, and then they went off, and so on. And I realized the problem that having this gun in my hand and having that sense of being a guard was like making a huge gulf, a gap, a kind of a boundary between me and them. And it was in my mind and in their mind, but this thing just in a way came between us. So I had that experience, and I threw the gun away and I went home, and I said, I understand now that this thing is painful, and it's not principles, it's experience. It's really a painful thing to do. So it's kind of shifted from a view or a principle to an experience, and that was a good lesson for me. But I think that we need to have less views, to be less clear about them and us, to be less clear about what is a fact, reality, to be, what is reality? To be more open about what is a tree, what is a person, what is the me, to see the world in a much more dynamic way, just like a child in a way, a wise child, to see things moving, dynamic, questioning, unsure, but full of life, full of freedom, inner freedom, more open. And this way we engage with the world, so that every time we come to a place which is difficult, we find ourselves more open and free, and not preconceiving what is needed, or what, just to be, have this sense of openness. For example, to let others tell us what is right for them, and not to come with a strong agenda, coming with our views. And that's not stepping back, it's actually engaging, but giving respect to the other. What is it that they want? Where are they? Let me look you in the eyes and try and see where you are, and I'll come to you, and then maybe I can help then from that place. So thank you. I think I'll stop there, and I'm actually not sure how much time when we have to finish.
Well, we usually stop at 9.
Oh, okay.
What I'd like to suggest, we have a metta song that we usually sing at the end. I thought if we sang that, then those that have to leave could leave,
okay,
and those that want to stay and do questions or whatever.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Is that yeah, that's lovely. Yeah, great.
Mm-hmm.